thanks for the introduction. Thanks also for the opportunity to speak here. So yeah, the talk is essentially about a framework based on exactly normalization group, which the calculations that we've done in SUN Yang Mills without fixed exchange. So here's an outline. So for an introduction, we'll introduce ERGs in a very generalized setting, and it's this generalized setting that will ultimately enable us to construct not only ERGs for SUN Yang Mills, but those for which we don't need to fix exchange. So we'll start off by introducing some scalar field theory, and then we'll take the first step towards the gauge case. However, we'll then require a detour, because, of course, putting a gauge theory, or not building gauge theory into the ERG, is not trivial, because you're a cutoff, you just sort of cut off in straight away, break state address, before we get the transformation mix, the manager of the mode. So in section three, we'll discuss a regulator which works on real gauge array cutoff, and as such, companion to use within the ERG. That will then enable us to construct the ERG we're interested in. So we'll write down the regularized flow equation. Then all of the work we've done, or much of the interpretation of the flow equation, is best seen through diagrammatics. So I'll introduce those, and then I'll give an example of how you actually use the diagrammatics in the perturbative regime, and finally conclude to talk about future directions. So a little bit about the motivation. So why the ERG for calculations? And the most promising feature is that renormalization is built in from the start, and also it's preserved in pretty much any approximation you care to make. So this has made it popular over the last number of years for non-perturbative approaches to gauge theory, precisely because the renormalization is there from the beginning. Now, for our purposes, we'll make a huge amount of use of this. We have a great freedom in the way we construct these ERGs. And in particular, one of the things that freedom gives us is that we can construct ERGs for which the gauge invariance is manifest. And in turn, as well as being novel, this has a number of distinct benefits. So the first is that the gauge field will not renormalize. The Ward identities take particularly simple form, particularly simple diagrammatic form. And also, of course, Riemann problems are entirely avoided. However, irrespective of whether one chooses to construct this for gauge theory or scalar field theory, the freedom of construction guides us towards what we're calling this universal diagrammatic computation. The idea is there's a huge freedom in construction, and many of these details are simply non-universal details that shouldn't affect the physics that you're ultimately interested in. Now, by leaving these non-universal details unspecified, essentially unspecified, the calculations become very constrained. So if you're computing a universal quantity, you know that these details have to cancel out, but you know very little about them. In fact, the only way they can cancel out is if you've got one here, another one, the opposite sign. This is so constraining that calculations can be performed through basically an iterative diagrammatic procedure. And we also use the freedom, this is a point of convenience, so this straightforward renormalization will lose. So what this means is, in our regularization scheme, as well as the physical field, we also have an unphysical field. And it's technically useful for the flow equation to treat these two fields differently. I'll mention this throughout the talk at a number of points, which should hopefully illuminate it successively. By the end, it should be clear exactly what I mean by this. So what's the current status of this manifest gauge invariant ERG? Well, in 2004, I computed the 2-degree beta function. And this was sort of the end of the testing phase, if you like. So it really confirms the consistency of what we're doing, I think, beyond reasonable doubt. And so we're now ready to start applying this perturbative and non-perturbative domain to see if we can get something new and useful out. So here's the basic idea. So for this part of the setup, we'll just deal with scalar field by working in Euclidean dimension D. So here's a little graphic illustrating what we're doing. So we're starting at some high scale here, some bare scale, so this is the bare cutoff associated with the bare action. We're integrating out modes from here down to this effective scale, so you can see here we have effective cutoff and effective action. Also on this picture, you see we've got this CIR, so this is an infrared light function, so it lives in this region here, cuts off the modes down here. And conversely, we've got a UV cutoff function, which lives down here and cuts off the modes up here. And so the UV cutoff function satisfies a number of properties. So if the argument z, which is some function of t on the ERG scale, goes to infinity, then this function must go to zero. In other words, it's probably regulating the degrees up here. And also, if its argument is zero, it's just one, which is telling us it's leaving the physics alone. Now, having performed this integral, this is what we'll be doing. We're basically interested in the modes that live down here. And you can view the modes down here, or you can view rather the modes up here having been cut off through the implementation of a regularized propagator. So one way of thinking of it is we can imagine that the propagator itself has been regularized by the cutoff function itself. And so we'll be working down here with the UV cutoff function, and the modes up here are effectively regularized. So that's the basic idea. We'll now move on to ERG in a far more generalised context. And the key to this is the continuum version of Kalman blocking. So on the lattice, you can imagine you've got a lattice with spins at each point, and you want to average over groups of spins. And the actual blocking procedure itself is largely arbitrary, and certainly, physics shouldn't depend on the way in which you do this. There's a large freedom, and the continuum analog of this freedom is what allows us to construct very general Zeeman normalization groups. But yes, this is what I've just been saying. So here's what we do. So phi of x is our blocked field. Phi 0 of x is the microscopic field. And b is some function. So there's an example function. But essentially, some localized function, so you really are...
Oops, sorry, I forgot to put the recorder everything here. Thank you.
Yeah, so there's some example of B of X, so B of X is the blocking function, which is just ensuring that you're averaging over some localized patch. So what we want now is we want to relate the action in terms of the blocked field to the action in terms of the microscopic field. So I'm just going to write this down, this relationship, and I'm going to justify that it's sensible. You were to integrate both sides by d phi. So this is clearly just the partition function in terms of the variable phi. To perform the integral here, and what this is telling you is that the bare partition function is equal to the block partition function. In other words, that under this integration out, the physics is invariant, which of course is how you want to set the whole thing up in the first place. So given that this definition is sensible, we now use this definition to define this object here, psi of x, as follows. And doing this, we can then write the following. So we can write the flow of e to the minus s in this form. And you see that, of course, if we integrate over d phi, we're basically saying that the flow of the partition, or the partition function, flows into a total derivative. So this, again, is basically a statement that the physics is invariant under the flow. And so this is our starting point for our generalized ERG. And by a choice of psi, which essentially corresponds to a choice of the blocking, we can choose psi to give us different renormalization groups. So we'll now look at a series, or an example, rather. So let's suppose that we take psi in this form here. So I'll explain what all the bits are. So first of all, this guy is an ERG kernel, so it's basically connecting something with an argument y to something which I haven't yet written with an argument x. We'll sort of understand more what this is as the talk goes through. Sigma 1, the thing sitting up here, so S is just the Wilsonian effect of action, and S hat is a so-called seed action. I'll explain on the next transparency what that is. For the time being, just suppress curiosity about this and go straight to the equation itself. So we can plug this back into what we had on the previous transparency and get an equation for the flow of the Wilsonian effect of action. And it has this form here. So we've got this first term, this classical term, and something which generates the quantum corrections. And here's the form that these take. And you see that there's this dot notation that lives here. So the dot's just defined as following. So if this thing depends on x and this thing depends on y, then this kernel, the position space kernel, depending on x, y, such that the dots just tell us that we integrate over the undetermined coordinates. So I'm going to be a bit more specific about a certain example of this in just a second, but before that, I'll just talk about what the seed action actually is. So the aim of the flow equation, of course, is to solve for the Wilsonian effect of action. The seed action is essentially a non-universal input, which is controlling the non-universal details of our flow. So this is in some parameterizing some of the information about the blocking procedure that we use. And it has the same structure and the same symmetries as the Wilsonian effect of action itself. So an example. So if we take the seed action just to be the regularized kinetic term, then we end up with, up to a discarded vacuum energy, the Polchinski equation. So the thing we had on the previous transparency, if you like, is just a generalization of that equation, which allows for an arbitrary seed action rather than the seed action just restricted to the kinetic term. So of course, the Polchinski equation is a perfectly good equation, so why take a general S hat? Well, the first point is that this is necessary for the generalization to Yang-Mills. But there's also a more subtle point, and I mentioned this at the beginning. This is part of the thing that guided us towards this universal diagrammatic calculus. So again, this seed action, which I've said is non-universal, is largely unspecified, and it's this that we often find cancelling, or we find cancelling diagrammatically. And at the end of the talk, I'll give an explicit diagrammatic example of how the seed action cancels out. So in addition to specifying the bare minimum about the seed action, we also specify the bare minimum about the cutoff functions and the flow equation itself. So when I write down the non-abelian flow equation, in fact, we'll be dealing with an infinite class of flow equations. And this is what I've said already, so the cancellation of the non-universal quantities becomes so constrained the whole thing is done diagrammatically. But you could argue, certainly for scalar field theory, where you know that you don't need a general S-hat, why bother taking a general S-hat at all? Because you've taken it general, you've discovered this clever diagrammatic trick, so why not just simply take the simplest one that's suitable for your purposes? And the interesting thing is that this question really seems to be moot. So something that I've done is you can prove to all orders in perturbation theory the beta function coefficients actually have no explicit dependence on S-hat at all. So,
can I miss the point? S-hat is related to your choice of cutoff, or?
S-hat is related to your choice of blocking.
Okay.
So it's something we never really choose explicitly, but that's what it's related to. So, yeah, you can prove that the beta function coefficients, and you'd expect more general quantities as well, have no explicit dependence on S-hat. And what this is perhaps hinting at is a more direct framework where S-hat is operating in the background. So what I mean by that, you're starting off with your flow equation, which has terrific amount of non-universal detail. But when you actually start to perform calculations, if you like, you're arriving at what is perhaps a better starting point, where these non-universal details are no longer appearing. And this is something which certainly merits investigation. I'll comment a bit more on at the end about that. So that's the basics of the setup. So now we'll try and generalize this to gauge theory. In the U1 case, this is really simple. We just replace phi with the gauge field A mu. This is our flow equation, so this is exactly the same as before, but just the phi is replaced. And the point about this, for abelian gauge theory rather, is that d by dA mu is itself gauge invariant. And so this equation, as it stands, is gauge invariant. And in fact, we haven't fixed the gauge, so it's manifestly gauge invariant. And that's essentially the end of the story. However, for SUN Yang-Mills, things are much more complicated. So the first point is that d by dA mu transforms under the adjoint representation. And so this equation, if we were just to write this down for non-abelian gauge theory, is no longer gauge invariant. But the solution to this is actually very simple, particularly from the picture we've got of these very general ERGs. And we want to choose psi as follows. So previously there were these dots rather than these curly brackets. What the curly brackets tell us is that this object is some covariantization of the kernel. So remember that the kernel is connecting points at x and y, so one particular realization of this, you could have a straight Wilson line going up, a straight Wilson line going back down. That's one particular realization of the covariantization. Again, as with our philosophy, we don't want to specify the particular details. We need know only that covariantizations exist, and we're never really going to have to specify much more than that. And also note that compared to this equation here, where we've got the sigma 1, we've now got a different quantity, sigma g. And this is because we scale the coupling out of the covariant derivative, and the reason we do that is because if we make this scaling, given that we have manifest gauge invariance, we find the gauge field doesn't renormalize. And so it's convenient to make this scaling out, and so this changes our variables very slightly. However, this isn't the end of the story. So what we've done is we've covariantized this thing here. We've essentially tried to install a covariant cutoff, which we might hope would regularize the theory. But the problem is that the regularization actually fails at one loop. And this is ideologically very similar to Slavnov's covariant high derivative scheme, which suffers from exactly the same problem. So here's a way of solving this problem, sort of schematically. In addition to your covariantization, you want to add a set of Pauli-Villars fields that cure the divergences that slip through. And sort of the whole system, if you like, will provide you with the regularization that you're looking for. And so the way that we do it is we embed the physical SUN in a spontaneously broken SUN bar N gauge theory. But the idea being that the heavy fields which we give mass act as precisely the correct set of Pauli-Villars fields.
Yeah, before dimensional regularization came along, I mean, there were people trying to actually construct Yang-Mills theory in this way by the combination of hierarchical vectors. And it was never clear whether they had a consistent framework.
I believe that Slavnov did eventually succeed in doing it. I'm not sure of the details. I know that his set of Pauli-Villars fields is very different from ours, and certainly I don't think has as neat an interpretation. And I also think that Tim, at any rate, spent some time trying to, at least looked at Slavnov's scheme to see whether it could be implemented in DRG, and it didn't seem obvious or even necessarily possible. But there is Slavnov's alternative scheme for trying to do this. So the heavy fields act as Pauli-Villars. So here's how we do it. So we'll work in a defining representation. So this guy here, this is a superfield, and it's valued in SUN bar N. Its Hermitian, being in SUN bar N, the whole thing is super traceless. So by the super trace, we mean the trace of the top block diagonal minus the trace of the bottom block diagonal. And the covariant derivative is constructed as follows, where, as I mentioned on the previous slide, the coupling has been scaled out. But other than that, the construction of the gauge theory then looks exactly the same as the construction of any other gauge theory. It's just the symmetry you're dealing with is novel. So let's look at its decomposition. So this guy here, the top block diagonal, this is the physical gauge field that we're actually interested in. here we've got an unphysical copy sitting down here, and this comes with wrong sign action, and it's quite easy to see that it has wrong sign action. You see that the supertrace is the trace of the top block minus the trace of the bottom block. So when you can't start constructing gauge invariant things like supertrace f nu nu squared, you're going to pick up an extra minus sign in the bottom part. And so we better find that in the limit that we send our cutoff scale to infinity that this thing decouples, as I'll talk about shortly. And from our point of view, the other important thing is that in the broken phase, this guy has its own coupling, which renormalizes separately from G. So this is another step along the road of what we mean by suitably general ERG. It's because these couplings renormalize separately that we want the flow equation to treat these two guys differently. And again, hopefully this will become clearer as we go through the precise reason why we want this. On the off-diagonal, the wrong statistics fermions, these are what we give a mass, and they act as the Pauli-Villars fields. And finally, we also have the central term, this A mu of naught. And the important thing about this guy is that it's associated with a generator in the one direction. So when we start to construct kinetic terms, which obviously comprise commutators, this is never going to appear, and so it doesn't have a kinetic term. So let's look at...
Before you spontaneously break the symmetry, what is the status of the renormalization status?
Right, yes. So the covariantization plus this, yes, the whole thing is finite. But, yeah, we obviously want to break it so that...
Okay, so you also need these other terms on the previous slide.
Yes, so the whole covariantization of the... Yep. So in fact, it's because the covariantization applies to the whole gauge theory, this means that the problem of overlapping divergences isn't an issue for us. So it's not that we're applying covariant cutoff regularization to A1 and then just supplementing that by Pauli-Villars. It really is that the covariantized cutoff is applied to the whole thing. And so the whole thing really is properly regularized. So here's the local invariances. So the first term, this is just SUN bar N invariance. This is what we'd expect. This term is something that we insist on. So as I've said already, the field A mu of 0 doesn't have a kinetic term. If it were to appear anywhere else in the action, it would act as a Lagrange multiplier. And this would probably kill the regularization. Certainly, it's not desirable. And so we simply impose that it never appears in the action. Now, one thing that one might wonder is whether you can simply just remove A0 from the beginning and just be done with it. But the point is that the fermionic gauge transformations will actually always regenerate it for you. So the only way to really get rid of it is through some non-trivial set of constraints on the various vertices in your theory. So then that's the only way you can really completely get rid of this guy.
Is this some kind of Lagrange multiplier?
It would, A0 would be if it ever appeared. So we want to ensure that it never does, and so we insist that this symmetry is obeyed.
Okay.
So here's a comment on the symmetry breaking. So we're breaking SUN bar N down to the bosonic subgroup. And we do that using the superscalar field C. Now, we potentially at this point have two scales. So we've got the scale of the covariant higher derivative regularization, and we've also got the scale of the Pauli-Villars regularization. And the two needn't be the same, but we obviously want them to be the same. And in fact, the mass of the Pauli-Villars fields will only track the covariant higher derivative scheme if we insist on the following. The first is that we require a novel dimension for this field here. So we take C to be dimensionless. And in the seed action, which of course we have a lot of choice over, we choose the effective potential to have a minimum at this point here. Now, given these two points, this then forces the minimum of the Wilsonian effective action to have its minimum at this point also. That's automatic at the classical level. But at the quantum level, it needs to be imposed as a constraint, which essentially can be translated into a constraint on the seed action. So let's just look at the particle content in the broken phase. So we've got the massive Higgs field, C1 and C2, just the block diagonal components of the superscalar. We've got this composite field, FR. So this B mu was the fermionic, the off-block diagonal parts of the supergauge field. B are the off-block, the block off-diagonal parts of the superscalar. So R is just a 5 index, so the first 4 obviously run over the Lorentz index of this, and the fifth counts the D. And the point is that the reason it's useful to construct this composite object is that B and D gauge transform into each other. So in a more familiar context, if we were to actually go and fix the gauge, then B eats D in a unitarity gauge. But of course, we don't fix the gauge, and so it's this statement which is relevant to us. Either way, however you look at it, these things are propagating together. And so this is just useful to combine them into one object. And when we come to the diagrammatics, we'll be dealing with the field F rather than B and D, and so it simplifies things for us. We've also got the masters fields A1 and A2. I'll comment a bit further on that in a second. And we can ignore A0 if we adopt a particular diagrammatic prescription. So this is by no means trivial, that you can adopt a particularly pleasing diagrammatic way of looking at things, in which case this field never appears. And certainly for the purpose of this talk, I'll just assume we've done that, and so get rid of it completely. Now, A2, as I said, has wrong sign action, and so we'd better find that this thing is decoupling properly in the limit that we send the cutoff to infinity. So the first point is that A1 and A2 only communicate via massive fields, so they're only communicating via the Bs and the Ds. The next point is that this theory is renormalizable in D less than or equal to 4. And the lowest dimension effective interaction, so if we integrate out the heavy modes between A1 and A2, is irrelevant. And these points then tell us by the Appelquist-Carazzoni theorem that A2 does decouple as required. So this thing really is acting properly as a regulator. And this is, we'll now come back to a point at the beginning. So the flow equation, if you recall, is constructed such that physics is invariant under the flow. And this is now important, because certainly if we send the cutoff arbitrarily high, we know that we're just dealing with physical SU and Yang-Mills. At some intermediate scale, obviously we have some hugely complicated effective action, not just depending on the physical gauge field, but also these unphysical ones. And so if you were just to look at this as it stands, you might not be sure that we're really dealing with SU and Yang-Mills theory at all anymore. The point is that if we remove the cutoff, we are. So we're dealing with SU and the top point of the flow. We've constructed things such that the physics is invariant under the flow. So that although the action may look very complicated and may not look very pleasant, we do know that these unphysical fields really are playing the role of regulating fields, and they're not affecting the physics.
So, I mean, one might have thought you would make them A2 massive as well, that is, with some additional stage or some of your rate number. That's not useful, or...?
I think that we probably could. In fact, yeah, I'm pretty sure that we could, but I don't think that it's necessary that we do so. But I think in principle, there's no reason not to. But I just don't think that it's for this in this context. It's not necessary. If we were trying to introduce massive quarks, I think it becomes or may become unavoidable. But certainly at this stage, there's no need to give A2 a mass. So we've basically got everything we now need for our manifestly gauge invariant regularized flow equation. So the requirements are SUN bar and invariance at high energy, no A0 invariance. And as I've said already, for convenience, we want to treat A1 and A2 asymmetrically in the broken phase at any rate. So here's the flow equation. So it has exactly the same form as before, but now all we've done is replace the dots here by curly brackets. We've incorporated the covariantization. The gauge field obviously becomes the super gauge field, and we have an additional term of exactly the same structure, but which involves the super scalar field. And similarly, the quantum term has a similar generalization. And this is basically it. So, as I mentioned right at the start, probably the best way to interpret this equation really is through diagrammatic means. And so here's the first step of the diagrammatics. We want to introduce a diagrammatic interpretation for the action. So if we introduce diagrammatics for S and sigma G, and also for this guy here, we can substitute these diagrammatic expressions in and just recast the flow equation in diagrammatic form. So here's what the action would look like. So the first thing we might write down is this term here. So we've got a symmetry factor of 1/2, a vertex coefficient function, and also a supertrace over the fields. And, you know, we've just arranged so that the argument AA here just matches the fields in there, so it's a sensible way of defining the coefficient function. And diagrammatically, we just represent the coefficient function, so as you want from your diagrammatic, you don't want your symmetry factors floating around, and we're able to strip this off, which will essentially become a common factor when we start to perform calculations. So our diagrammatic flow equation will just be in terms of the coefficient function. This is a 2A vertex, so we've got two wiggles. When we move on to the 3-point vertex, we have three wiggles. At the 4-point level, things are a little more complicated. So if we've got four gauge fields, we can arrange them either all four in one supertrace, or we could have two in one or two in another. We couldn't have three in one and one in the other because A is supertraceless. So if A sits in a supertrace on its own, the whole thing vanishes. But the nice thing about the diagrammatics is that these coefficient functions are just treated together, so they're treated in parallel with each other. And similarly, in the C sector, we have the following vertices. So dotted lines represent the Cs. The only difference really is that C itself is not supertraceless, and so it can sit on a supertrace by itself. And then we have mixed vertices.
Why aren't there more terms, more fields? Because there.
There's a sort of plus dot dot dot, if you like. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, so obviously, the action just has an infinite expansion, and gauge invariance is relating the various coefficient functions to each other. The S's, so these are functions of momenta and cutoff.
Sorry. And so that whole, you say that whole action has a gauge invariance, you can write, it's just the ordinary, I mean, is it a recovery gauge invariance?
Oh, right.
Gauge invariance of the theory?
Yeah, so, so the invariance. So this, the whole action is just invariant under this expression.
Just normal gauge transformations, otherwise.
Just normal gauge transformations, although we've all got the additional a zero symmetry, which enforces an additional set of constraints. But yeah, it's just the normal thing. And the relationships between the coefficients are particularly simple because of the fact that everything is manifest.
So what kind of action is this? Is it the effect of that?
This is the Wilsonian effect of action, yes. So this is the action defined at the scale lambda.
You read up physical consciousness.
Sorry?
You read up whatever you want to know about the theory of.
Well, for beta function coefficients, we can calculate at any scale. To perform calculations of more general objects, then I think at the end of the calculation, you probably want to set lambda down to zero, ensure that you're integrating out all the modes. So here's the diagrammatics in the symmetric phase. So we'll look first at the classical term, which we recall takes this form here. And the point is that S and sigma G are composed of supertraces and products of supertraces. And one can think of the functional derivatives as simply breaking these supertraces open. So we can imagine a supertrace sitting here and a supertrace sitting here. They're broken open by the functional derivatives. Everything's super gauge invariant, and so it has to be tied back into a supertrace by the covariantization. So we'll see this in action. So we'll just focus on this part of the flow equation. And we'll consider the flow of the two-point vertex. So obviously there's all the other terms in here as well, but we're not interested in those for this purpose. So on the right-hand side, we've got the overall factor of a half. Then we've got the diagrammatic expansion of S, we've got the diagrammatic expansion of sigma G, and then we've got the derivatives and the covariantization. So what's going to happen up here is d by d is going to hit the supertrace. Obviously, it can hit either of these fields, and the factor of 2 will cancel the symmetry factor, as we'd hope. And we're going to have a lone A, if you like, sitting up the top. Exactly the same thing is going to happen down the bottom, and so this thing must tie everything back together into a supertrace AA. And at that point, the supertrace AA will match between this side and that side. And so that's something we can just strip off. And so that ultimately we'll be left with an equation just in terms of the vertex coefficient functions and this kernel sitting here. So explicitly, this is what we've got. So you can see everything has been tied back together. We've got a sort of complete diagram, if you like. The quantum term follows through just exactly the same. Now, for consistency's sake, we need to take it that the covariantization of the kernel, if hit by the derivatives, is zero. So essentially, this thing is transparent to the d by da's. And so both derivatives just hit sigma g. And now we've got two derivatives striking sigma g, so this is going to knock two fields out of the supertraces. And so here's what happens. So this is just the same vertex we were computing the flow of before, but now rather than looking at the classical term, we're looking at the quantum term. So we've got two fields on the left-hand side, so we have to have two fields on the right-hand side. We're now distributing them in all possible ways. So in the first diagram, this is just a sum over all the possible kernels, so the delta dot AA and the delta dot CC. And you see that this thing here is a four-point vertex, the two A's and the two ends of the kernel. But the kernels themselves, since we've covariantized it, also possess vertices. And so just like the vertices of the action, they too can be decorated. And so these are two of the vertices of the kernels. And we've just taken the fields, the two fields, and distributed them in all possible ways around the diagram. So in the broken phase, things are effectively exactly the same. So here's the flow of some vertex. This is a sort of a template for the classical term, this dumbbell structure. This is a template for the quantum term, which we just saw, this sort of padlock structure. And these fields sitting up here, these Fs, can be any of the broken phase fields. They can be A1s, A2s, C1s, C2s, or the Fs. And the rule is we just distribute these in all possible ways. So on the classical term, we can put them on the blob up here, we can put them on the blob down here, we can put them in the middle. And this guy, as we've seen, we can put them on the lobe at the bottom, or the vertex, or the kernel itself. One of the nice things about the diagrammatics is embedded within the diagrammatics is an actual prescription for evaluating the group theory factors, so we don't ever deal explicitly with the Castanets and so forth. The group theory actually is embedded within the diagrammatics. And the internal fields label the kernel. So what I mean by that is this line here, at any rate, this is a sum over the kernels. This is the kernel. So we could think of a field, let's suppose the field A1 is sitting up here, field A1 is sitting down there. So this tells us it's an A1 type kernel. And in the broken phase, each of the broken phase fields has a kernel associated with it. And this is, we're getting some way towards understanding my comments at the beginning about sufficiently general ERG. So we want the ERG to be sufficiently general, such that the A1 type kernel is different from the A2 type kernel. And in a few transparencies, we'll see precisely why this is useful to have. So we'll now look at the weak coupling limit. And so we perform the following expansions. So this is an expansion of the Wilsonian effective action. So we have, obviously, the classical effective action and all the various loop corrections to that. The seed action has a similar expansion. Now, rather than dealing with G, so we've got the, well, we've got these two couplings. We've got G, the physical coupling, and we've got G2, the coupling of the unphysical gauge field. And it's just convenient to change variables. So we introduce alpha as G2 squared over G squared. And so rather than dealing with G and G2, we'll be dealing with G and alpha. So the beta function is defined as usual to be the flow of the coupling G, though note now that the beta function coefficients can, and in general, do depend on alpha. And gamma is just the flow of alpha itself. So this now is the classical flow equation. So this is basically exactly the same as before, but now with, rather than dealing with the full Wilsonian effective action here, so rather than having S's here and sigma G's here, we're just looking at the classical parts. So this is obviously the classical two-point vertex, same here, and this is the classical version of sigma G. The dot stands for lambda lambda, and things are now performed at constant alpha. So when we perform our weak coupling expansion, we also want to match powers of G on each side of our equation. And as such, since alpha itself flows and has some power expansion in G, we perform the derivatives at constant alpha. And something I haven't mentioned until now, there's actually a dot sitting on this guy here. So we've just taken the kernel to be represented diagrammatically like this. The real point is, though, is that you can take the lambda lambda here, or take the dot seriously. And so this really, this object is usefully thought of as the derivative of something else, as we'll see in a second. And sigma naught is just S naught minus 2S hat, so we can expand that out. Here's the naught part, and here's the hat part. And this is now a point where we can again use the freedom in the seed action to our advantage, and we make the following choice. We want the two-point classical vertices, the seed action and the Wilsonian effective action, to be equal to each other, and this is just a choice. It's a choice consistent with this equation, but it's a choice that we're free to make. And the reason it's useful is because these two diagrams now become the same. We can see at the moment that the top bit's the same anyway, the middle bit's the same. The only difference is between this bit at the bottom. By choosing these the same, we can just take this diagram and directly subtract this one as follows. So what we want to do now is we want to integrate this equation up, because all we've got is we've got the two-point vertex here, here, and here, and we've got this kernel. So we'll now say a bit more about these vertices. So the first thing we can use is gauge invariance. And gauge invariance tells us that the vertex is transverse. Now, we know that this is a dimension, has mass dimension 2. And given that it's transverse, there's thus only one thing that we can write down. So this is some dimensionless function of P and lambda. And this is transverse, and as usual, we just represent that by the box. And now our strategy is simply to substitute this form into this equation. So on the left-hand side, we obtain that, where the lambda d lambda, of course, just strikes the A of P, this being independent of lambda. And on the right-hand side, we can simplify things because box times box is P squared box. And now we just rearrange this equation to obtain the following form. And we can integrate this directly because we've got a lambda d lambda sitting here and a lambda d lambda sitting here, and of course P itself is independent of lambda. So integrating this and choosing the integration constant such that this thing here, delta 1, 1 of p, is well behaved as p tends to infinity, we have the following relationship. And we can see that this is going to be useful to us, because if we imagine now multiplying this term here by a delta 1, 1, then on the right-hand side we're going to have this here, and so we can replace it, we can simplify using this relationship. And this is what we find, in fact, if we multiply delta 1, 1 by here. And this is sort of at the centre of everything we do, so I'm going to write this down again. And what this is telling us is that this integrated kernel, this delta 1, 1 of p, is the inverse of the classical two-point vertex, but up to a remainder term. So the remainder term is sitting here. And we call this a gauge remainder because it's forced to be there by the manifest gauge invariance. And this tells us that despite what sort of may at first appear to you or may not, delta 1, 1 of p is really not a propagator. Because it's not the proper, it's not the true inverse of the classical two-point vertex, it's only the inverse in the transverse space. And we know that we can't even define a proper gauger in the usual sense, at any rate, because we haven't fixed the gauge. Nonetheless, from our point of view, we recognise that delta 1,1 of p, it plays a role very similar to a proper gauger in our diagrammatics. So we're never trying to interpret it as a proper gauger or set it as a proper gauger, but we recognise its similarity, and so we refer to it as an effective proper gauger. He said it's a useful interpretation, but there's no gauge fixing required in its definition. And we also note that the relationship to the two-point vertex is ultimately down to a choice of seed action. So when we constructed this whole thing, we chose the seed action two-point vertex equal to the Wilsonian action two-point vertex. And this was a choice down to convenience, but one which was by no means forced upon us. So the emphasis of this transparency, if you like, is that this object delta is similar to a propagator, but by no means a propagator in the usual sense. Now, this relationship here, we call it the effective propagator relation, and the nice thing about it is that it actually holds in all sectors with the correct diagrammatic prescription. So this is now a two-point classical vertex in any sector, so the field sitting at either end could be A1s, C1s, A2s, C2s, or the Fs. This is the associated effective propagator, and since it always occurs as an internal line, we just attach it to an arbitrary structure. This is the Kronecker delta part of the relation, and this is the gauge remainder. We've already seen what this remainder is in the A1 sector. It has various interpretations in the different sectors of the calculation. So in the C sector, it's null. In the F sector, it has these five indices sitting at the two ends. And this is really now what we mean by having a sufficiently general ERG. We know that A1 and A2, or the couplings associated with A1 and A2, we normalize separately. And so we know that the two-point vertex in the A1 sector cannot be equal to the two-point vertex in the A2 sector. Given that we want this relationship to hold, it must be the case that the ERG is sufficiently general to allow the A1 sector effective propagator and the A2 sector effective propagator to be different from each other. And this is really the this is really what we mean by allowing the exact renormalization group to be sufficiently general. And it is just a point of convenience. As I said, this relationship doesn't have to occur, but it's very useful for us to have it occurring, because whenever this appears in a diagram, we can simplify this diagram using this relationship. And I'll now show you how that's done. So I'm going to illustrate this by calculation of, or partial calculation of, the beta function coefficient. And any calculation of a universal quantity is going to be controlled by the renormalization condition from G. And if you like, this is the one place where physics is feeding into our systems. All the rest is non-universal detail, but this is where the physics is really coming in. And what this does to us is it constrains the order p squared part of the two-point vertex. So this thing here, the order p to the 4 term, this is contained in these ellipses. So all universal quantities depend only on the order p squared part of this. And since we've got the effective propagator relationship, it sort of induces, if you like, universality in the 1 over p squared part of the effective propagator and also the gauge remainders. However, everything else has to cancel out in the computation, and that occurs diagrammatically, as we'll now see. So suppose that we look at the n plus 1 loop flow equation. Then this is part of what we'll find. So we've got dependence on the beta function, the n plus 1 loop beta function, as we'd expect. There's a classical term which I haven't bothered to draw, so I just want to focus on this quantum term here. So I should say that this is the n plus 1 loop flow equation with two computing the flow of the two-point A1 vertex at the n plus 1 loop level. So this guy, this sigma, we know it has a seed action part and a Wilsonian effective action part, so we just expand that out. And now we want to expand this out further. So we know that these fields here can be distributed in all possible ways around this object here. So there's going to be one diagram in which the kernel isn't decorated and a set of diagrams in which it is. So we just divide that up. So the first one, that must be decorated. The second one, it cannot be decorated, and these two are complementary. Just sum up to give the original diagram. Now, if this isn't decorated, this is no other than lambda d lambda of one of our effective propagators, and we can process this diagram using the flow equation. So we take it here, so I've just redrawn it, and what we do is we want to now move the lambda d lambda off the effective propagator to strike the diagram as a whole, and of course we have to compensate for the term in which it strikes the vertex. And this is something we can just compute. This is the flow of an n-loop Wilsonian effective action vertex, and so we can use our flow equations to process this. We generate a whole set of terms, and amongst the terms we create is this one here. And the reason I've chosen to draw this one is because this contains a two-point vertex attached to an effective propagator, and we know that we can simplify that using the effective propagator relation. And now the key point is that those two diagrams are exactly the same, and they cancel. And so we've seen this cancellation of part of the seed action without ever having really specified anything about it. And now we just simply iterate this diagrammatic procedure. So for at each stage, we isolate and process any diagrams that we can. We apply the effective propagator relationship, and at each stage this is going to allow us to identify a series of cancellations. Then the remainder terms, it turns out that those two can be processed diagrammatically, and we do that. And then we just iterate this whole procedure. And if we do that, we ultimately find that all these instances of the seed action and so forth are cancelling. And so we find to all odds and perturbation theory that the seed action cancels out, the explicit instances of the seed action, and so too do all explicit details of the covariantization. So an obvious question is, what's left? Well, we've got the Wilsonian effective action vertices, the effective propagators, and the gauge remainders. And these things are by no means universal. They've got universality in them. They've got universal components embedded within them, but they're not universal themselves. And so how do the remaining non-universal universalities cancel? Or indeed, do they cancel? So at one loop, as one would expect, this whole thing is trivial. And you just obtain a one-loop beta function. At two loops, things are more complicated. But what you find is there's an iterative diagrammatic procedure to remove the remaining non-universalities. It's similar in ideology to what I presented on the previous slide. Now, if you've got this iterative diagrammatic procedure at two loops, you might well suspect that, in fact, you've got this iterative diagrammatic procedure at any number of loops.
That's a certain point. The beta function itself is not universal.
Right, so this is the point I'm coming on to. So what my statement would be is that there's a strong suggestion that all beta n can be arranged to depend only on the universal details of this ERG. So to put it another way, if you imagine the complete space of regularization schemes, then for that complete space, you don't expect, for the massless renormalization schemes, any agreement beyond two loops. However, my claim would be if you now zoom in just to the part of this space which corresponds to the infinite number of renormalization schemes that we consider at the same time, then I'm speculating, but sort of well-motivated speculation, if you like, that for those schemes, you could arrange for the beta function just to depend on the universal details of the setup. So it's by no means a claim that the beta function is universal, but rather that there's a universality in this restricted sense, or possibly in this restricted sense. So this would be something that certainly I'd like to complete the analysis of, and so here's some of the future directions I want to look at. So in the perturbative regime, I want to complete this analysis to find out whether, you know, how much of the universality really does cancel out. Certainly prove that large portions of it do. It'd be interesting to extend this now and see what happens. And also want to move on to start calculating more general quantities, such as the expectation values of gauge invariant operators. More ambitiously is the non-perturbative direction. So the first thing we could do is we could perform truncation. So this is something which is standard in the field and is used in alternative ERG approaches to the to gauge theory. And of course, one advantage that we'd have in this system is that for a start, we'd never have to worry about Grebov copies, which cause considerable headaches to people who do this in other schemes. And also, in the other schemes, what people want to do is they want to make statements about confinement and so forth. And of course, these statements are very strongly gauge-dependent in general. So if we were to perform similar analyses in our framework, we'd hope that any statements we do make, well, any statements we do make, of course, would be gauge-invariant. So that would give us an advantage. Now, more ambitiously, and so probably far less likely to work, is the idea of a strong coupling expansion. So let's begin by assuming that the coupling blows up as lambda tends to infinity, as lambda goes to zero. And this is something that we plan to check at least is plausible by using a truncation. But there's no reason to suspect that this shouldn't be the case, because after all, the dependence, the behavior of G, really depends on how you define G in the first place. Now, if it is the case that this is true, then it would make sense to perform an expansion in 1 over G squared as follows. And now I'm just going to give a list of some of the things that we think would naturally come out of this. So this is by no means a list of things we've proven, because this is just speculation, but things which we hope in this framework might be particularly transparent. So the first is that we'd expect to see dimensional transmutation. So we've got this expansion here. We know that 1 over g squared is going to 0. And let's suppose that this thing really does make sense, so that the thing remains finite. And suppose further that g squared, 1 over g squared is going to 0 is some power of lambda. Then we know that there must be compensatory powers buried in S1, otherwise the whole thing will vanish. So these powers of lambda are going to cancel, and what's going to be left? Well, we know that we can expand the vertices in momenta. There's got to be something to make sure that everything has the right dimensions. And so one might hope that you'd be able to naturally see in this framework the emergence of lambda QCD. in sort of conjunction with that, we could conceivably get a signature for confinement. So, as I said, what you're hoping to see is you're hoping to find a cancellation, if you like, between the zero of this part and something in here. Now, the only place that that can't happen in principle is for the two-point vertex here, because this is controlled by the renormalization condition. So the renormalization condition forces the order p squared part to take this form. There clearly can't be anything to compensate as 1 over g squared tends to 0, and so this will just vanish. And so what we'll find is that this vertex starts not at order p squared, but at order p to the 4, and we could perhaps interpret this as a signature for confinement. The next thing, and certainly really related to all of this, or hopefully related to all of this, is this notion of a more direct framework. So this is something I've been intimating at all along. So we're starting out with this very sort of non-universal framework, if you like. We're finding the cancellation of these non-universalities. Can you formulate the whole thing such that, in some maybe even independent of the ERG itself, so that, if you like, you're coming in at this later stage? And this is something we think it may be possible in principle. Perhaps we could do this via some functional means or whatever. And of course, if one were able to do this, then you'd hope that this thing would be defined non-perturbatively, and this might shed some light on this, or vice versa. And finally, we think we're finally able to incorporate quarks. So this is actually quite a subtle matter because of this no A0 symmetry. So let's use the board. So the sort of most obvious way to try and embed the quarks is inside some superfield psi, as follows. So this is just the physical quark field here, and this is some unphysical component. However, when you construct a term like psi bar del mu psi, this is going to contain an A0 component. It enforces a constraint, and it seems that the only solution to the constraint is actually that it sets the dynamics to zero. So you need to be more elaborate in the way you do this, and the way that we think we can do this is instead we want to embed the quarks into the adjoint representation. So now we'd have something like this. We've got a psi 1 by 2, and then here are the physical quark fields. So this would have the artifact that there are going to be some unphysical symmetries left over, but we think that those will be removed in the limit that we tune G2 to 0 at the end of a calculation, and we're fairly sure that we can do this, embed the quarks in that way, enabling us to hopefully simulate full QCD. So thank you very much.
As you go to higher orders, does this help at all with proliferation diagrams? I mean, is there...
Right, yeah, so this is an interesting question. So if I can just let me just go back a transparency. So when we did, when Tim did the one loop calculation originally, it was very much along these lines here. So, you know, you do this procedure, and it's quite long, and there's about 100 diagrams. Now, we did this at two loops. This is my PhD project, and we didn't quite have an idea of how many diagrams this involved, and it ended up involving about 10,000 of these wretched little things, which were drawn out by hand, which is clearly, you know, you can't go beyond two loops in that sense. However, it was the key point in turning this from something really more of a novelty and something that could potentially be useful was when I realized that this whole procedure is just algorithmic. And so rather than doing going through and doing each of these diagrams individually, you can use the fact that it's algorithmic to simply derive your final formula. So essentially what's left at the end of the day is just terms of this form here, so these terms in which the whole thing is hit by lambda d lambda. And what I've done is I've actually derived the formula to all orders where it's just these types of terms that appear. Now the number of those types of diagrams with loop order I don't think is any worse than in standard methodologies.
Not better.
Not sure.
Technologies in the market now which have fewer twisters.
Yes, I mean, it depends what you're computing. I mean, because... So the question, I guess, would be best answered when we start computing things like gauge invariant operators. I mean, I certainly think that for beta function coefficients, this is as efficient, if not more so, than any other method.
The ERG equation itself really has two terms, but somehow when you actually try to apply it, it expands out into the usual.
Yeah. I mean, yes, I suppose the key point about the ERG equation is that if you start off with an n-loop vertex, it's always generating an n plus 2-loop vertex, and this is the real source, I think, of why you get this proliferation of diagrams. But I think that although when we first started working on this, it looked like the proliferation of diagrams in our scheme was untenable, I think it's now clear that it's certainly no worse than any other, and perhaps even better.
And have you tried adding supersymmetry?
We haven't, but I don't see any reason why we shouldn't be able to incorporate that fairly straightforwardly.
Yeah, if the n equals 1 level, there's no problem. I mean, if you try to go all the way to n equals 4, it might be harder, but you don't have a superfield form. There's no automatic way to preserve it, as far as I know, with these derivative actions.
I don't know.
What kind of things can you compute with that scheme?
So, in principle, at any rate, we should be able to compute anything that's gauge invariant. So if we wanted to actually compute amplitudes, then presumably what we'd have to do is we'd want to compute the expectation value of something that's gauge invariant, and then we want to gauge fix at the end. But whether we want to do that is another question. I mean, this formalism is designed for computation of gauge invariant operators, and so it's natural to go in that direction.
Usually when you compute amplitudes, is it that you compute any functions of diagonals with many legs, which are where the legs are themselves gauge, right? Gauge covariant.
Well, so
that's I think the usual thing you compute for scattering.
I mean, well, one thing that we're certainly not able to do is we can't have any on-shell gluons in this. But you know, we haven't got a propagator. So if we wanted to do anything with on-shell gluons, we'd need to, at some point, fix the gauge.
But if you just computed, well, you could compute many point functions of gauge invariant operators.
It's certainly in principle. Yeah, we haven't actually done any, but one should hope that we could. Yeah.
Okay.
In fact, I mean that's one of the very next things that we want to start working on. Because also the other thing about sort of starting to compute these quantities is it will hopefully allow us to start really linking this in with conventional methodologies.
But so far you can only treat SUN.
Yeah. So this was something I was chatting about actually the other day with Itzhak Biles, who of course is an expert on supergroups, and he thinks that for SON and SPN it should be fairly straightforward.
Well,
you have to.
Sorry? Seven.
Pass. But I don't know. Yes, we have only done SUN, but one might hope that you could do it for other gauge groups as well.
Are you working on your ability for E7? What? Are you working on your ability for E7?
Yeah, in the last 7
numbers.
No, I want to ask. Would it help if the theory itself is finite? I mean, say you started with saying it's 4, and could you maybe go get around this SUM/N?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that regularization schemes built up on that idea, I'm not sure how convenient they would be for implementation into the ERG. I think the point about this regularization scheme is this is really tailor-made for incorporating into the ERG.
Anybody else? Any questions? Thank you.